Welcome to the 128th episode of Reverse Sweat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
Happy 46th birthday to one of my true cricketing heroes, Shiv Narayan Chandrapur. I'd like to think that he's celebrating with a game of beach cricket in Guyana, resplendent in his crab stance and refusing to let anyone else have a bat.
And the great thing about being Shiv is that you know that you have given school children the world over the example that they can hold up to their schoolmasters when they say you have to bat in a certain way in order to be great. You have to be textbook. He is the definition of the non-textbook. And in this episode of Reverse Swept Radio, we're going to be celebrating a very non-textbook reverse sweep in a minute. Andy's also going to be telling us about the fusarium test, which isn't a phrase that I thought I would ever say. And we're also going to be reviewing Original Spin by Vic Marks. Now, Andy, something caught your eye on Twitter.
Yes, so county cricket is back and it's been great. It's been an absolute joy to have it back, and the Bob Willis Trophy is filling a gap in the summer that we thought was going to remain unfilled. So Nick Gubbins, Middlesex batsman, is very good. He'd struck a superb 192 in their first innings against Surrey and was on 60 in the second when calamity struck. He goes for a reverse sweep, misses it by a fair way, and has his middle stump knocked out the ground. Now, that description doesn't really do justice. Go and look this up on Twitter and appreciate it in all its magnificence. There's always a bit of arrogance in the reverse sweep. You're sort of saying, I'm totally in control of this bowler. I can do what I want. So when it goes wrong, it is humiliating. And this goes so, so very wrong.
I only saw it for the first time a couple of minutes ago. And it's not necessarily that the bowler picks that the batsman's going to play a reverse sweep. It's simply that Gubbins falls over almost as the ball leaves the bowler's hand, which is an unfortunate position to have to end up playing cricket shot in.
I think it's exactly that, in that I think generally the reverse sweep nearly always involves a degree of premeditation, unless you really are, you know, incredibly
quick, yeah.
Your reactions really are extraordinarily rapid. So he premeditates, and then it's actually a half decent ball. I mean, it sort of pitches on leg and goes on to hit the top of off. So it's probably too good a ball, perhaps, for one thing. But it's the overbalancing. The reverse sweep is sort of, to play it is to be kind of, you have to be sort of totally in control. And it's that moment where he goes for it and ends up planted on all fours, which is just never how you want to, it's never how you want to go. It's never how you want to.
And there are two things that I think absolutely perfect it. One of which is that actually middle stump comes out of the ground, which I think is just a great kind of, symbolically just shows the complete castling of the batsman. But then also the non-striker, I'm not sure who it is at the non-striker's end, just desperately trying to avoid looking down the pitch at Gubbins at the other end in his moment of humiliation. I mean, as a non-striker, you're probably cracking up at that point, to be honest, but clearly just trying to look anywhere other than at his teammates.
So we go from a current Middlesex star batsman to a former Middlesex star batsman who is making his way at Yorkshire now.
Yeah, so David Milan has been someone who, those cricketers who have been in a long and proud English tradition of the nearly men, with amazing talent in sort of all formats of the game. He had that T20 debut where he scored 78 off 44 balls in his first international for England. He then scored one on his Test debut. He then scored that amazing century at the WAC. It was this kind of stop-start, up-and-down Test career, until it all came to a kind of screaming halt when he basically, you know, Andrew Strauss came out in 2018 and said, "Nah, we just don't think you can cut it. We think you can, you know, play good innings overseas, but we just don't think you're going to be someone who's going to be long-term in the England setup anymore." And it all kind of came crashing down for Milan at that point. He was captain of Middlesex. That came to an end, and he moved up to to play for Yorkshire. And you kind of felt, he's 32, this is just going to be a bit of a sort of sad, slow decline. So I was overjoyed today to see that in just his third game for Yorkshire against Derbyshire, he scored a century at Headingley in particularly difficult conditions as well, by all accounts. So whilst it's late for, you know, at the age of 32 for him to be making a comeback, there is something quite nice that after surviving a torrid couple of years, that there seems to be, you know, something of a next chapter in his career.
You are responsible, Toby, for costing me about 10 minutes of my morning, because I was reading about Milan this morning and I could think back to a wonderful T20 innings I saw him play as a youngster at the Oval, where he was just extraordinary. Mm. And I promptly went down the kind of scorecard black hole and just couldn't find it, which left me thinking, you know, did it actually happen? Did I imagine it? But I think the age point is a really fascinating one, because there is obviously a bit of a shift towards some very talented up-and-comers. You know, you look at Ollie Pope and you look at Zach Crawley in the England side, and you do wonder what it means for a David Milan. You know, does the England setup instinctively start looking to the future? But then, you know, this is a guy with a test 100 in Australia. England have got to put together the best possible team they can to, I know it's not all about the Ashes, but a lot of it's about the Ashes.
It often is, yeah.
To try to regain them next year. So who knows? You know, hopefully goes well at Headingley and maybe gets himself back into the reckoning.
But I think he's also one of those who, because I was flicking back through his scores, and he's one of those people who just pop up all over the place playing remarkable innings. Mm. He has truly had a pretty amazing career, and was never actually given enough of a go at test level. I mean, I think he played 15 tests.
I always have a lot of time for those players. And I, funnily enough, it sounds like a weird comparison, but Mark Stoneman, who was the Surrey opener, I always feel a bit similar about, where they did the hard yards in county cricket. They finally got their call up. And I just feel they were dumped way too fast. The Milan thing, I mean, you made the point that there was this super weird thing about basically being told, we think you can probably get runs for us abroad, but you can't do it at home. And you're saying that to someone who's obviously made a lot of runs in the county championship.
Well, exactly. Who's totally honed himself in the county championship.
I think it's this, I mean, you could do a whole feature though. This youth age thing is fascinating, because obviously you want to bring through the next generation, but actually at the same time, you want to balance that with putting out the very best 11 you can. And like someone like Ollie Pope, I mean, I've had the chance to watch, you know, more of the cricket than normal recently, and Ollie Pope is clearly pretty special. Yeah. And you might as well just get him in and get on with it. But someone like Zach Crawley, I'm like, he's clearly talented, but I mean, I think he probably needs to do those few more years in county cricket. You know, I'm not sure he's ready. So why not?
Well, that pipeline just doesn't really exist. Doesn't seem to be what is thought of as being the route, which is spend a few years in county cricket and then graduate to the, you know, the international side after that. It's basically show promise and come straight out of kind of the academy straight into the international setup. It's not...
You've got to be a freak for that to work, I think. And Alistair Cook did it, right? Like, Alistair Cook, I'd love to know that fact, actually, but I think he'd barely got, you know, he'd barely played for Essex and then... Yeah. But he was clearly a freak of nature. I mean, most...
Yeah,
of them
and those... And those people who have done it the other way, who get called up fairly late in their career, are kind of notable as being exceptions. I mean, you think of Graham Swan, you think of someone like Ryan Sidebottom. I wonder whether they're slightly afraid that if you do that, then you end up having to, you know, where does it end? Because there are so many people who actually end up making a ton of runs at county level. Someone like James Hildreth is a really interesting
example. I always feel so sorry for James Hildreth.
For the England team, but just went through season after season after season, scoring thousands of runs for Somerset.
Yeah. He is actually the best example. He is definitely worth it from the archives one day. And there must be a story there. I don't know what the story is, but like how on the weight of runs he scored, he wasn't worth a run at some point is just... It just doesn't make sense.
There are sometimes these perceptions that seem to come up, which are, oh, he'll struggle against X.
Yeah.
And that just comes to sort of stick on someone. That's the reputation they get, and it becomes the known truth that, yes, they might be scoring all these runs, but...
But how? Yeah.
Maybe the kind of Graham Hicks, you know, cursed it in the sense of he proved that, and others like him proved that, that major county success doesn't necessarily translate. And so maybe it's just kind of thinking, well, that's not a barometer.
No, I mean, it is absolutely true to say that it doesn't always work. And obviously, sadly, you think of like Ramprakash as well. But like, it's just with Hildreth is just the weirdest one. Like there's one thing with Milan where you're like given a chance and it's taken away from you too quickly. But how you could just ignore someone for that, weird. Anyway.
From the archives, and for this, the 128th episode of Reverse Swept Radio, Andy is going to be taking us back to the Fusarium test.
It's July 1972 and we're at Headingley, the fourth test in the Ashes, one apiece with two to play. Ray Illingworth's England were the holders, so Ian Chappell's Australians need to win the series to regain the urn. Now, Headingley's reputation in recent years may have changed a little bit, but at this point it was very much seen as a seamer's paradise, and the Aussie attack, including the great Dennis Lilly, was looking forward to it. Instead, they found a pitch that the soon-to-be man of the hour, deadly Derek Underwood, described as damp, entirely grassless and mottled, seemingly perfect conditions for spin bowling. We all know groundsmen are locked in an eternal struggle with the elements, so I think we can sometimes be too tough on groundsmen when we you know, blame the pitch on them. In this case, they had to deal with some slightly dramatic stuff. A heavy storm a few days before had soaked the pitch, and the groundsmen claimed that when the pitch dried out, it became infected by a fungus known as fusarium, which killed off the grass. Now, the Royal Horticultural Society, not a regular source of research for this podcast, informs me that it's one of the most damaging diseases of turf grasses, sometimes known as snow mold because it's very common after snow melts, which I think snow mold sounds altogether nicer.
It does, doesn't it? So were these cover pitches at this point, or would they have been uncovered, do you know?
This is a very good point. I think this was still in the age of uncovered pitches, but that
I'm being a bit mean. Given that you went to the extremes of yeah. calling up the Royal Horticultural Society, I shouldn't really grill you on the details. The other thing I suppose is interesting is that it does make you realise, when you get to this level, it does make you realise the outfield making sure that stuff is mown. You know, the level of kind of detailed, complicated, not sometimes we don't probably give groundsmen the due that they deserve.
Yes, and I think it's this point, and we have touched on this before, that when we all sort of go, or the public kind of go for groundsmen, we sort of forget this idea that actually you're working with what you're given and you cannot conquer sort of, you know, a massive thunderstorm. However, the Australians were not buying the excuse of fusarium. Greg Chappell noted that it was uncanny that it only attacked a strip 22 yards by 8 feet and the rest of the ground was perfectly healthy. And on this point, the Aussies seem to have a case, because apparently the pitch next to the test one was in perfect health with plenty of grass.
Why couldn't they just switch over? Well, presumably because the other one just hadn't been prepared for cricket on that level.
Well, that's a very reasonable question in itself. Why not play on the pitch that hasn't got fusarium? Adding to their suspicion was England's decision to bring in Derek Underwood for the first time in the series. The view was that this pitch was perfect for him. I'm actually inclined to defend England on this particular point, because his selection seems quite logical. Norman Gifford had taken just one wicket in the previous three tests as England's lead spinner, so dropping him for Underwood feels a reasonable call.
Isn't the other part of this, though, and this is why it's odd that they decide that they have to come out and say it's fusarium and we couldn't have avoided it, because isn't it the home side's prerogative to prepare whatever pitch they want to prepare? That's always been the case. It's still the case now, isn't it? That's part of being at home.
I agree. I think this is what's fascinating, was if it was a lie, and we don't know if it was a lie, it's interesting that England felt the need to lie. So I think we grumble sometimes about overly advantageous pitches prepared for the home side. And I think, you know, we occasionally have these soul-searching things about, is it ruining the game, etc., etc. But I think nowadays we completely accept that it's a home team's right to do that. And I think actually in England, we get quite grumpy sometimes when we don't. You know, we think, why on earth are our groundsmen making this more difficult for ourselves? But it's absolutely right to say that at this point, it clearly was not accepted or seen as the done thing.
So my other question is, where was the kind of horticultural Miss Marple who could be sent around to take swabs of the pitch and go away and provide a kind of independent analysis? It is interesting, though, that if this was being claimed, that and the Australians were there and feeling incensed that, you know, there wasn't a way of going, well, what's actually happening here?
This is what makes it very interesting going back to this, because I thought, oh, this would be quite fun to play play horticultural Miss Marple myself with my, you know, minimal knowledge of fungi or grass or really any gardening at all. But it's quite
with a pitch that had long with a pitch ago. I mean, this has all of the ingredients
of a successful investigation. You could presumably have just tested this, right? I mean, my in-depth research suggests that you can go on YouTube and find plenty of ways to test for fusarium. So why didn't one of the Aussies just demand doing that? I mean, I wonder if it plays into this thing that actually, however much the Australians were unhappy about it, they were under strict orders from their team manager not to grumble. And I think this is where these things, you know, the 50-year difference, you know, both on your point that England felt they needed to lie, but also on the Australian side that they felt they couldn't complain, or at least complain too publicly. So at this point, we have talked a lot about the pitch. How did it actually play after all this?
Yeah, what happened in the game?
Well, exactly. After all the talk of fungus and mottled pitch, what actually happened? So Australia...
It didn't turn an inch. Well,
Australia win the toss and they make steady progress. They get to lunch at 79-1. Then Underwood and his captain and fellow spinner Illingworth set to work. 93-2 becomes 98-7. Apparently it is turning square. The pair ruthlessly constrain the Aussies. They concede just 69 runs off a combined 52 overs, which even in an age of slightly slower run rates is pretty brutal. Underwood was to reflect that Illy was a great bowler to have at the other end because he was as mean as I was. Australia dismissed for 146. Now, England's innings follows a similar pattern. They're comfortable against the seamers, but they get into similar trouble against the Aussie spinners, Mallett and Inverity, sliding to 128-7. But Illingworth, he's at it again, and John Snow put together an improbable centuries partnership that gives England a basically decisive advantage in the game. And on the basis of reports from those who were there, Australia's spinners were a bit more inexperienced and they just don't seem to have been able to maintain the stranglehold that England did.
What I find slightly puzzling about all of this is if you've batted first and you've seen the ball turn square, surely you just open your innings when you're bowling with spinners from both ends. Surely you take advantage of the pitch. Or maybe this is actually something to do with what you were saying about the weakness of the Australian spin attack, and maybe that's why they, you know, felt so aggrieved by this in a way, because they knew that wasn't an option.
I think it's an interesting point in both innings, and I just wonder whether now you would see a captain in that situation being quicker to do that.
This wasn't the dumb thing.
Yeah, I think, you know, would you have just been faster, you know, after a couple of overs of your seamers being pretty inoffensive, would you just throw the ball to your spinners? Things get worse for Australia. So the pitch is now wearing and Underwood is even more unplayable in this second innings. The dismissal of Doug Walters gives you a sense of what's going on. The ball pitches on leg, launches from a length and touches Walters' glove on its way to first slip. So pretty unplayable stuff. I think for balance, though, it's worth noting that there was some terrible batting going on. So Greg Chappell was seemingly panicked at the mere sight of Underwood, which you could perhaps understand with the way things were going, slaps the ball to mid on with a shot described as unworthy of such a player by the Sydney Morning Herald. Australia are routed for 136, and for the loss of just one wicket, England scored the 20 they need to retain the Ashes. Underwood has 10 for 82.
That'll do.
It's not bad, he probably
slips a fiver to the groundsman after that, I imagine.
10 for 82, remarkably not the greatest figures of his Test career, which says something for Derek Underwood. But he and the rest of the team, though, have little time to celebrate, which another example of how different the 50-year gap makes life. The early finish on the Saturday, which was just the third day of the Test, meant players were sent back to their counties to play in the John Player League the next day. So I thought, you know, you've just retained the Ashes. You've just thrashed Australia. Back you go for another game the next day.
Yeah, back you go to your county and off you go. I'm interested in your point about Greg Chappell and some of the bad Australian batting, because I wonder how much this affected people mentally as well as literally, in the sense of if you have this whole furore before a game about all the pitch has been doctored and it's going to do all of these extreme things and X, Y, and Z, I wonder how much that, you know, has an actual effect. And it sounds like from that account of Doug Walters' dismissal that the ball was turning significantly, but I think maybe as a whole team you just go in with a mindset that this, and that's obviously what spin has done in so many different ways over the years. It's how Shane Warne plied his art on any kind of pitch, getting inside people's heads.
I mean, the thing, I guess, and this has been used as the defence of home teams who prepared interesting pitches down the ages, is ultimately the pitch is the same for both sides. And I think what ultimately decides this game, I mean, it's easy to focus on Underwood's figures, is that in that first England innings, Ray Illingworth and John Snow dig in, and they make this 100 partnership, and it's slow, you know, tough going, and they do it. And I think, however aggrieved the Australians feel, that the fact is that both sides had to deal with this turning pitch, and England dealt with it somewhat better. I mentioned earlier the Australians were under strong orders not to blame the pitch. This was, you know, seen as very poor sportsmanship. I enjoyed the fact, however, that the Australian media was far less restrained. The Age ran the headline, "Pitch wins, with England close second." To the review, and for this episode we've been reading Original Spin by Vic Marks. It was published last year and is Vic Marks' autobiography, covering his early life, his career with Somerset in the time of Botham and Richards, his time as an England ODI and Test international, and finally his conversion to Observer and Guardian writer and TMS broadcaster. So we've got these two sides of Vic Marks. How does Vic Marks the writer regard Vic Marks the cricketer?
I've always thought, from his commentary that I've heard on TMS and his various writings for The Observer and The Guardian, that Vic Marks is just a really nice guy. And that is the big thing that comes across from this book. So Vic Marks, looking back across his career, he doesn't have axes to grind. He's not trying to prove a point, and he's not trying to tell the world or prove to the world that he is a brilliant or was a brilliant cricketer or a brilliant writer. You just get the sense of this guy, he's looking back at his life and gone, I'm really lucky, I had all of these amazing opportunities, and wasn't it a whole lot of fun? And even though he didn't have the biggest international career, one of the things that's really interesting about Vic Marks, as you just said, was that he lived at a time when, and he came into contact with a whole lot of interesting cricketers and a whole lot of interesting scenarios. So he was at Somerset when the whole Botham, Viv Richards, Joel Garner, you know, saga went down. So actually what's really interesting is seeing his perspective on these different times that he played in as well.
Well, the fact that the proof of how humble he is that the first page of the book is about Viv Richards, not him, which is pretty modest when you're writing your own autobiography. I mean, the fact he has no axes to grind makes this in some ways quite an unusual autobiography. I mean, generally, even a pretty contented cricketer has a few. But he's very clear about that early on. He says, don't expect too many revelations. And I also quite like the fact that he tackles a few of the sort of conventions of cricket biography. He refuses, for example, to give us the usual number of funny sledging stories, declaring that I can't believe anyone thinks these stories are true, and as time goes by, it's just as surprising that anyone thinks them funny. And then finally, he admits something that I don't think you're ever really allowed to admit, which is that he's actually forgotten a lot.
Yes.
So he talks about being dismissed by Sylvester Clarke and says, I suppose I was disappointed. I might have been relieved. It's a long time ago now. And sometimes, as a biographer, when you're writing your autobiography, you sometimes have to pretend, keep up this fiction that you perfectly remember every moment. And it was somehow quite refreshing for him to be like, don't know really.
Well, because that's the value of why people read the book, is to get that perspective of the moment from the person who was there. And yes. he also talks for a little while, in fact quite extensively, about the fact that he has all these memories of games, and he goes back and checks them against the score. You know, he's absolutely convinced that he got out to so-and-so, or so-and-so, you know, caught whoever, and he goes back and he looks at the scorecards, and those other people just weren't playing in that game. And he's absolutely upfront about that being the reality of it. Now, obviously we know Vic Marks mostly now as a commentator, and actually a lot of the details of his career, you know, I knew he was an off spinner, I knew that he was obviously a Somerset man through and through and had a bit of an England career, but many of the details of his career I didn't really, you know a whole lot about. What did you learn about him as a cricketer and about his career?
I think it was very interesting the way that he, in some ways, was a bit of a trailblazer as an ODI specialist, as a sort of ODI that he actually found himself, that was really where he had greater success, certainly for England. I think it was very interesting. It is overwhelmingly, as you say, a book about how content he was, how happy he was with his career. It's why the few moments when he wasn't really stick out. Mm. So he talks about being humiliated, his words, not mine, by Abdul Qadir, and it really brought home quite how, I mean, we've talked a lot on this podcast about how brutal and tough cricket can be, but that idea that it was so embarrassing, you know, to think you're a good batsman and then find yourself totally at sea. And he talks about the relief of getting out. Now, I mean, you've already touched on the Somerset saga, which, yep, you know, if you read enough books about this period, you run into from different angles. Did you feel you got a lot more out of this, and sort of did this story that was already quite well known?
Yeah, so what So one thing that I hadn't quite realised was how much, how close to it Marx was, to be honest, because in a lot of accounts, Marx doesn't appear as a kind of central character. He was, you know, the kind of standing vice captain through that time, and actually expected at the point that Botham was sacked as captain to be elevated to the position of captain. Apparently there had been kind of, you know, conversations in which that was strongly inferred, and Marx is very upfront about saying at the time he was pretty pissed off that he wasn't offered the job. It went to Peter Roebuck. And what's interesting is that, again, going back to the point we started off on in terms of sort of Marx's sanguine perspective on things, he says, well, actually, whilst I kind of expected it at the time, maybe I was presumptuous in that, and maybe there are actually good reasons why I wasn't offered it, and my actual, you know, that my inability to be bullish enough as a leader and sort of forthright enough as a leader actually could have led to that. So he's able to sort of take that step back, but at the same time he's a diplomat. He points out repeatedly he was the only person who both Botham and Roebuck was talking to, and it seems like he kind of wants to preserve that now, because we don't actually hear from him the detail. I mean, he kind of says, yeah, everyone on both sides was both right and wrong, but we never hear anything particularly incisive from him on that front. I think,
and I think it's consistent with his approach throughout that he blames himself in some way. Right, he said, well, I had no divine right to be the new captain, but stupidly I'd assumed that would be the case. Now, I think in most autobiographies that would be an axe being, you know, heavily ground. I mean, we get the end chapter in this book called Loose Ends I think shows both maybe some of this book's strengths and weaknesses, in that he kind of canters through an awful lot of material that he hasn't managed to cover elsewhere in the book. I mean, what did you sort of get out of this kind of manic finale to the book?
It's about 15 pages in which he covers off, you know, the death of Peter Roebuck, about which thousands of pages and articles have been written over the last few years. He talks about, remember this was only written last year, so he's talking about some fairly up-to-date things as well. He talks about the 100 and some of his thoughts on the 100, his thoughts on the direction of the ECB in general. And I have always found Vic Marx to be a very thoughtful and insightful commentator, and I found that to be the case here too, but I kind of wanted it to go a bit further. I think I wanted actually to spend a bit more time hearing about his thoughts from his experiences on these, you know, different very significant chapters in cricket history.
I rarely ever say this about a book we review, but it could have done with being a bit longer. I think he needed a bit of time, and it's a slightly confusing chapter, because as you say, you go from, you know, the tragic events of Peter Roebuck's death to the 100, and you're sort of trying to keep up. You're like, well, hang on, you haven't finished with that yet, and we're already jumping on to the next thing. But I think all in all, there's a huge amount to get out of this book, both about his life and also, as you say, I think the fact that it's not just his career, but also what he observed through his career, not just what he did, but what he saw. Where will this be securing a place in the, where in this, when your bookshelf will this be found, or will it be heading to the second-hand bargain bin?
It will be staying on the bookshelf, definitely. There is something, I love his prose. There's something very kind of comforting about the way that he writes. He's just a nice man, and he writes really well. And he's someone who you really enjoy spending time in the company of as a writer. There isn't searing revelation here. It's not going to turn the world upside down, this book. But I think it's definitely something to return to, and something that we'd recommend pretty highly.
And that was the 128th episode of Reverse Threat Radio. If you enjoyed it, do hop onto iTunes and leave us a kind 5-star review. Helps other people to find the podcast. And as ever, if you want to get in touch, we are at Reverse Swept on Twitter.